Good morning, Your Honors. The police court, my name is John Doyle, and with me is David Wenzel, and we represent the defendant appellant, the Maytag Corporation. This is an appeal from the jury verdict in which the defendant raised several issues, both pretrial and post-trial, with regard to the magistrate judge's denial of Maytag's motions in limine to bar the plaintiff's expert, James Petrie, under the various Daubert standards that this court has applied. We would contend that the trial court did not apply any of the Daubert standards applicable to this circuit. And additionally, we're appealing from rulings that were made not allowing defendant Maytag to argue that its warnings and instructions to properly ground the gas range, which is at issue here, would have rendered the product safe, and also whether the issue of misuse under the Indiana product liability, strict liability section is a complete bar. And finally, whether the failure to follow manufacturer's instructions constituted misuse under Indiana law. If I could address first the trial court's failure, fundamental failure to perform its gatekeeping function and responsibilities under Daubert, the defendant submits that with regard to that portion of the appeal, that the standard that this court should apply is a de novo standard. As we cited to the court in the U.S. versus Hall and U.S. versus Allen cases, first of all, the court conducts a de novo review to determine whether the district court properly followed the framework as set forth in Daubert. And in this case, we believe that the court made no attempt to follow Daubert in the pretrial motions in limine. And then second of all, if the court makes a determination that the district court properly applied Daubert, then the district court admission of expert testimony is reviewed under abuse of discretion standard. We would state that under the de novo review, looking at the record, the magistrate judge really conducted no Daubert analysis of Mr. Petrie and the motions to eliminate bar him. And even under abuse of discretion standard, because he performed no tests, had no scientific basis for his opinions, that even under abuse of discretion standard, that this court ought to reverse the findings of the trial court. The magistrate judge in this case did not make any attempt whatsoever to look at the controlling Seventh Circuit law and other authorities under Daubert, which governed the admissibility of the plaintiff's expert, James Petrie's opinions under what he calls a resistive short theory. Petrie's theories basically were novel.
Was that theory ever advanced by anybody else anyplace?
We've not found it anyplace. There is no cited literature for it. There's no scientific test for it.
Was the term familiar to you or anyone else in a court proceeding?
No. And if Your Honor realizes, electricity has been around for over 100 years. I'm sorry. And never has there been a mention of any type of a resistive short in any of the literature.
Do I recall he said he was working on something that would prove this theory?
Yeah. See, what he promised the court was this. The court had a lot of problems with his theories. If you look at the...
Well, what did he promise the court?
He promised the court that he was conducting conclusive tests that would absolutely prove his theory.
And were those tests ever brought forward, or did he purport to bring it? Did he say he was going to bring them forward?
He said he was bring them forward. He represented in his affidavit to the court, and that was part of the court's findings, and at no time did he ever bring them forward.
Okay.
His theory is novel in the extent that what he's talking about is somehow the dielectric strength or properties of the insulating materials on the wire for the gas range can break down and wear away gradually over time so that the current can somehow leak or pass through the insulation without any type of a direct cut or any type of a break in the wire. And this is what he calls a resistive short. Mr. Petrie would admit that if the plug to the range, which is a grounded plug, had been plugged into a three-prong grounded receptacle, which is where it was plugged into, and if there had been a direct short, this would have grounded out the range and shut down the circuit panel. The difference is in the trial testimony below, Mr. Chapman was responsible and did in fact wire a lot of the circuitry in the house and wired this particular receptacle and didn't put the ground in. In his Rule 26 filings reports and also in his affidavit in support of trying of the motion to bar his testimony, again, he goes through this issue of the insulation breaking down gradually somehow, that the dielectric strength somehow is decreased over time, and again, you have this leaking current. Mr. Petrie's opinions were not supported by any scientific method. He admitted, as the court noted, that his testing was amenable to scientific method. He specifically stated in his affidavit, "I am designing a test procedure which, when completed, will conclusively prove this to be true." He never did that. The only support that he really has for his leaking current theory is his own alleged personal observations that he makes at various times when he goes out there after the accident, which he says he plugged the range in or didn't plug it in, which is highly contradictory.
Did he give any other examples of when he went out and saw this phenomenon in any other place other than the instant case?
No. He cited no other examples. He cited
this is the only recorded example of this phenomenon that he described.
That's correct. And he only gets to this phenomenon of the leaking current or resistive short because of his personal observations, which he does not note down, which were not part of his Rule 26 report, which changed throughout, as we cite to Your Honor, the court, throughout the entire testimony. From the first time he goes out there, he finds a direct short. So later on, he testifies, "I was wrong, wasn't a direct short, because if it was a direct short, it would have grounded it out if the plug had been properly, receptacle had been properly grounded."
Don't all of your objections go to the weight of his testimony, rather than to the admissibility thereof?
Respectfully, no, Your Honor.
The way you're arguing?
Well, the weight of his testimony would be if he had some support for it.
I understood your argument to be that he had no right to testify at all because he had failed to make the standards of Daubert.
That's correct.
That's right. And I'm asking him if the argument that you're making here doesn't also go to the weight.
Well, I think the first item that the trial judge should have done under Daubert is weigh whether it's admissible. And what this court has said, to be admissible, he has to meet the various standards. It has to be supported by something. It has to be supported by...
Why is this resistive short any different than any other short?
Well, because there's never been any mention...
appliances.
Yeah. There's never been any mention of any type of resistive short in any literature, in any of the scientific
title. But is this short any different?
Well, because it's never existed before, it would be different. The only shorts that people are
by
aware of...
By title only, is that right?
Yes. Pardon me?
By title only.
Well, by title and how it supposedly works. A direct short, which would have been a break or a cut in the wire, would have been metal on metal, which would have... This is a 120-volt wire, which would have resulted in the circuit breaker tripping if it had been properly grounded. This resistive short, somehow the current leaks through the insulation. And he's never explained how it does that. There's no scientific test that he ever established it by.
Well, how is the result any different if it leaks through than if there's a simple break?
Because If it was a direct short, which is what the literature talks about, it would have ended up with a situation that it would have tripped the circuit breaker if the...
It was great enough.
If the plug, the receptacle to which it was plugged in, had been properly grounded. That's our contention.
Then the circuit breaker goes on, the electricity stops, and there is no electricity.
That's right. That's right.
Enough of a charge to trip the circuit breaker, isn't that true?
Well, there would be enough charge in a direct short.
I'm asking that. Yes. If there was enough charge, are all leaking elements equal?
Well, again, there's never been any scientific tests that have been set up or any literature that talks about...
Forget the resistive part.
Right.
Just the short part.
Well, the shorts that are talked about in the literature are direct shorts, not leaking, because when you have the insulation, it's called the dielectric strength of the insulation, protects the wire. That's what protects all wires from causing any type of electric shock. Somehow what he's contending is the dielectric strength breaks down over time, gradually. And again, this has never been noted in any literature or any scientific tests that have been done.
Right. Proceed.
I see the white light on. Do I need to...
That's your rebuttal time. Now you're chewing on it.
All right.
You understand the longer you talk, the less rebuttal you have.
I do. If I can, I think we've covered the various issues on the Dahlberg about the precondition. The court never did that. He never performed his test on any of his theories. His tests were never subject to any type of a peer review as looked at. There's no support in the scientific literature for it. He flip-flopped in his testimony. And basically, he failed to meet any of the standards in the O'Connor case and the Cummings cases that this court has looked to properly support his theory. With regard to the issue of misuse, I believe we've adequately covered that in our brief. The first issue is whether we had adequate warnings can render a non-defective product safe under Indiana law. We cite to the Marshall versus Clark case, where the court specifically held in Marshall and Diaz, where warning is given, the seller may reasonably assume that it will be read and followed, and a product bearing such a warning, which is safe for use if it is followed, is not defective condition nor unreasonably dangerous. And with regard to the design issue being a complete defense, we point to the court that statute has been amended twice since 1995. Each time the amendment, they reenacted the special defense of strict liability and misuse in a product liability case. We cite, Your Honors, the 1999 Smock decision, which clearly holds that it is still an absolute defense in a product liability action in Indiana. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning. My name is Greg Cross. I'm from Muncie, Indiana, and I have the pleasure and the honor of representing the plaintiff appellee, Vanessa Chapman, as special administratrix of her deceased husband, Kyle. Kyle was, of course, the gentleman who was killed in this very tragic and horrible accident. I would like to emphasize at the beginning of my presentation that once again, Maytag has taken it upon itself to mischaracterize Mr. Petrie's testimony, what his opinions were. The trial judge, in his ruling, overruling the motion for a new trial and remittiture, recognize that Mr. Petrie's opinions were not at all what the defendant would like them to have been. Mr. Petrie described this short as a resistive short generically. He was of the opinion that what he had done in his methodology, reference to page 20 of the plaintiff's appellee's brief, describes what that methodology is. And as he did that, what he did was a time-honored engineering practice. He eliminated other possible explanations for what had happened. And in fact, the One of the main things that Maytag has persisted in insisting upon all the way through this litigation is that Mr. Petrie did not come up with any further description of this resistive short at the outset, because it wasn't known until very late, in fact just 60 days or so before trial, that there was any dispute that the short was in the pinched wire behind the range. Up until that time, it was taken for granted by Mr. Petrie, and I think that's pretty clear from the affidavit which he submitted to the court in opposition of the summary judgment motion, that there was really no issue in his mind, and he perceived there to be no issue at all, but that the current which was escaping into the everyone agrees pathway which resisted Mr. Chapman's electrocution emanated from the pinched wire. There was the resistance in the circuit came there. That's where it was, because this house, which was built in the 1950s, was extremely well grounded. In those days, plumbing was made out of black iron pipe. That was the grounding mechanism. The electrical was all solid steel. It was a very well grounded house, as Mr. Petrie testified on a number of occasions. This house was redundantly grounded. There could have been 20 or 30 copper ground wires attached to this particular receptacle, and they couldn't have grounded this house any more than it was already grounded. So when Mr. Petrie reviewed these facts and made these observations in typical engineering practice, he concluded that there was no other, he had eliminated all other possibilities, that in fact the conclusion was obvious, that the source of the leaked current was in the pinched wire. And frankly, if the record I think is pretty clear, the Maytag opposition to that proposition did not manifest itself in the record until April 27th, when the defendant filed its reply to the plaintiff's submission on the summary judgment motion. For the first time, Dr. Newhafen, who was Maytag's expert, he declared that the instantaneous, what he declared in his affidavit was, that when this short took place, it happened instantaneously. The insulation protected all current. There could be no leaky. There was no cut. There was nothing. It was perfectly electrically sound until that happened. When it blew, all of a sudden we have full energization, and that's the only time at which there could have been any possible electrical escape of current into the system. So the problem with that is Mr. Petrie, in preparation for trial, April 27th, trial was August 5th, we didn't know. We had no way of knowing that there was going to be any dispute as to the fact that the pinched wire, or rather that anything other than the pinched wire. At trial, Mr. Newhafen testified that this was the culprit. This is Exhibit 78. This is an exact identical counterpart of Exhibit 78. This is the gas line. This is the gas line that we're talking about. And it's got steel grommets on either end, and it's made out of copper, I believe, and it's solid metal. Now, this is where Dr. Newhafen testified that the resistance was. He says that and we all agree, I mean, everyone agreed, the source of the electricity was the range. It had a short circuit at the pinched wire. So the current went into the chassis. From there, it went into this gas pipe. It went into the gas flooring, which went down through the furnace, into the heating ducts, which Mr. Chapman came in contact with. So as the trial court correctly recognized in its motion to deny the new trial, the parties agreed as to the pathway. They agreed to everything. The only difference was where. This whole case boiled down to where was the resistance that pursuant to Ohm's law, prevented the current that was leaking from reaching 20 amps so as to trip the breaker. If it ever had, that breaker would have tripped. And later on, as the contact became more solid, for whatever reason it became more solid, the breaker couldn't, it would always trip. It could not be kept on. And that did, in fact, happen. And the only explanation for that, this thing didn't change. The only thing that did change was the pinched wire. Now, Mr. Petrie described the resistive short. That was that's just a term that he used to generically describe what happened. We've all been shocked by bad wiring on something, an appliance or something, an old old electrical switch, something that, you know, is not in the best of electrical integrity shape, but nonetheless, it doesn't trip the breaker. I mean, we've all done that. That is the common experience that we all have. It doesn't rise to 20 amps, and it's not static electricity. There's something wrong. Whatever that appliance is, we throw it away. We don't take the chance. And the fact, well, may I say, with respect to the testing, Mr. Petrie made that statement in his March 7th, 2000 affidavit in opposition to the motion for summary judgment. At that time, as he described in some length in his second deposition, he said that his intent there was to replicate the entire process where insulation gradually would be cut. He was going to fix the box, and he was going to rub the insulation until gradually it came out. And he tried to do that, but he couldn't duplicate the knife edge effect this housing had on the cutting of the insulation with the precision necessary to keep it from to develop it slowly over a period of time. Remember that the factual record of this case indicates that the Chapman family were experiencing a multitude of electrical problems up until the time that Mr. Chapman was fatally injured. Those events varied in intensity. They got stronger, they got weaker, they happened in different places. Some were serious, some were not. And at one point, in fact, the night before Mr. Chapman was killed, a friend of theirs who was an electrical journeyman himself came out, he installed a new wire. They all thought the problem was solved. And so Mr. Chapman believed that there was nothing else wrong. They went around and inspected the sites of all of their other electrical shocks, and nothing happened. The next day, believing that nothing had happened, he was killed. Now, the jury probably thought that perhaps, as that journeyman electrician testified, that maybe Mr. Chapman should have gone out and done something else. He should have called the power company. He should have had somebody check the circuits a little better, because they did find fault. And that leads me into the next point I would like to mention with respect to the harmless error of the so-called the misuse defenses. You know, I don't even know why we're talking about misuse as an absolute defense, because if one looks at the instructions which were submitted by the defendant for consideration by the court, which was like a month, I believe, before the trial and a month before the pretrial order, which they are contesting now. The preliminary instruction, they basically said that misuse was something which would be compared. I may be specifically defining that too narrowly, but I do know that the preliminary instruction was pretty much a paraphrase of what Maytag requested in its proposed preliminary instruction, and Maytag did request the court to give a final instruction in which misuse was categorized as an element of comparative fault. There's been, simply put, no showing under Trial Rule 61 of any error in any of these things which would rise to prejudicial level. The point being that Maytag got to talk about its warnings as indecipherable and as vague and obtuse as they are, how a common person who buys a range from a warehouse distributor would have any idea what the applicable electrical codes were on the very vague and poorly drafted language of the warnings. The court had an opportunity to consider all these arguments of Maytag, and Maytag did get a misuse instruction. They did get an incurred risk instruction. They got to talk about all of the fault of the plaintiff that they ever could want. There was no error shown. There was no harm shown.
Mr. Cross, could we go back for just a moment to the possible grounding of this machine?
Yes, sir.
One theory, of course, is that there should have been a ground wire in the plug to which the machine was attached, and was not. That would have tripped the circuit breaker if it had been attached, I presume.
We disagree.
If the short had been at a sufficient voltage, right?
If the short had been what is called a dead short. In other words, a full metal-to-metal contact from the copper and the wire to the metal chassis of the range, then the current that theoretically would have been able to be escaped would have been unimpeded.
and would have escaped through that wire if it had been.
That is, if the ground wire had been correctly.
Now, in your brief, you talk about an alternate grounding of that machine.
Yes.
How did that work?
The way that it actually went.
We're assuming now that it would have been that it would have been a complete break, as opposed to what you, as to what
had that happened. Well, it would have made no difference because
it would have gone down the gas pipe, but then how would it have been grounded?
It was grounded because the measurements which were taken by Mr. Russell, Maytag's expert, and the measurements which were taken and introduced into evidence by Mr. Petrie clearly showed there was no resistance to speak of from the metal chassis, which is where we originate, all the way to ground.
Into the ground.
Ground is ground, wherever it is. Yeah, they measured it from the exact sources where they measured it to, but the exact path, the steel furnace. The ductwork was all metal, went into ground. The black pipes, which were adjacent to it, all went into ground. This house was infinitely well grounded. And that's the thing. If that's how it was determined that the resistance was at the pinched wire, even Dr. Newhafen was down to this being the only other possibility because his own partner's measurements established that there was no resistance all the way to ground once you got past this thing. And he didn't measure this thing until the oven was removed from the Chapman residence into my office approximately a year and a half after the accident. Was that clear?
Well, I'm still not clear, I think, on where the ground was when it went down the gas pipe into the heating system.
Yeah.
Into the ducts. How was that path eventually grounded?
Well, we don't know all of the pathways. I believe there were several. One of which was the gas piping actually went right through the wall, right below the sink, behind the where the range was, to outside where there was a gas meter, and there are photographs which were in evidence, and I don't have the numbers, of course, but they show that they are solid metal. And they go right into the ground. They're buried there. So the actual physical distance that the current going that particular path would have had to go to ground was no more than a few feet. But we believe that the heating duct work, of course, isn't attached to that particular ground wire.
Yeah.
That would have, how the most logical scenario for the current to escape that way was it went through the pinched wire into the chassis, into the gas pipes to the furnace. And then from there out to the ductwork. And I believe that the trial court recognized that in its explanation of the facts as well. So the one thing that just clearly establishes that Mr. Petrie's opinion is 100% correct was the facts. The fact that there was varying intensities, varying presence or absence of the electricity. It didn't exist. The only time, and he never specifically said, and I believe he said someplace in the trial record, he could not find, he did not know exactly what happened to the short. He doesn't know when it broke. He doesn't know when it terminated. He doesn't know any of those things. Only thing that he can detect from all of that was that there was electrical phenomena. It came and it went, and the measurements establish that that was the only place. And as it's been said before, that if you eliminated every other possibility, that's the only one remaining. That's what it is. And that is the methodology expressly approved by this court with respect to Daubert. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. 1 minute, all right.
Just a couple things. Counsel talks about the house being well grounded. In fact, the evidence would suggest just the opposite. There were a number of mini shocks that people were receiving. He did get somebody to come over who was just a journeyman to look at it. And what they did is they grounded the furnace. It had nothing to do with the gas range that we're talking about here. So this idea that this house was perfectly safe. The testimony was a lot of the receptacles had been wired by Mr. Chapman had been miswired. The issue, though, for this court is whether the trial court below properly applied the two-pronged test on Daubert to whether this testimony should ever be admitted. If you look at the trial court's own concerns, they point out the fact that he hasn't performed proper testing. The trial judge was very concerned about this, whether he had ever supported his opinions with any type of reliable literature. But Mr. Petrie goes on and says, I will perform these tests. I will conclusively prove it. And with regard to that, counsel makes reference that he tried to do it. There's no evidence of that in the record, that he made any attempt to try to do it. You can't represent to the court that I'm going to conclusively demonstrate something by testing, which he says this was susceptible to testing, and then not perform those tests. He basically does all of this on his own personal observations, which if the court looks at the record, change at least four or five times, and he simply says, I'm wrong, many, many times.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Judge.
We will take the case under advisement.